Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we're back, mostly in our respective cities, I guess.
Yeah, nobody's traveling right now. On the other hand,
like it's today. Like, right. I mean, that's going to change in 36 hours, I think, for several of us. But
it does seem a bit odd because it is presently October and it's definitely August weather outside. But there we are.
That's true. Lauren, what are we drinking?
We are drinking end of season rosé, even though rosé season should have ended like 2 months ago. And that I'm a sucker for the Josh Sellers rosé, purely because every guy I went to high school with was named Josh.
I have to say that I think you can drink rosé all year long. You can wear white jeans in January. I mean, these are all things that can happen.
You're very modern.
I struggle with the white jeans in January. Like, I want to, but I'm not there yet.
On the other hand, I do firmly believe in a pot pie season, but that is mostly for like pants maintenance as much as anything else. You can't eat pot pies basically from April till October.
That's fair.
So like you got to hold out to like 1 November for the first pot pie of the year.
Same thing with like chili. You can like kind of start now, but you have to eat it in certain forms. You can't just eat like straight up chili.
This is my general rule with eggnog for similar reasons.
Well, eggnog's disgusting.
You drink eggnog?
It's delicious.
No time,
oh my God,
for
I
eggnog.
Love it so much.
That's right. Your mom makes like really
coffee,
alcoholic eggnog.
Super alcoholic. And
nice.
It's amazing.
Oh, well, maybe I'd like it more, but like rum and milk does not sound like a combination that I just really ever want to be a part of, I have to say.
When I went to Mexico earlier this summer, there was a guy next to me at one of those Japanese like guy cooking in...
Hibachi.
Yes, thank you. Hibachi situations. Thank you. Nouns. He was drinking white Russians the whole time.
Oh, well.
It's the foulest thing I can think of with like Japanese hibachi cuisine.
just makes you think of Lebowski,
oh,
minus the hibachi.
Right.
Anyway, there's a new podcast from our friends at War on the Rocks. It's called Net Assessment. And folks who don't quite get enough foreign policy fix from me and Lauren and Radha might enjoy listening to that. And I'm sure it's delightful and folks should check it out. We're going to move on to keeping up foreign relations. And honestly, most of the stuff that we have this week, I mean, we struggle with where we've been some of these stories each time we go through. But we want to start up keeping up foreign relations with some good news. The Nobel Prize for Peace, the Peace Prize was awarded this week. Lauren, what happened?
It was awarded to two individuals whose names I'm probably going to butcher, but we'll make the attempt. Nadia Murad and Denis Mukwege. Nadia was a Yazidi woman who was kidnapped by ISIS and victim of sexual violence, who eventually escaped and is now in Germany. She has written a memoir. She has been a very powerful activist for her peers who have likewise been the victims of ISIS. And just meant like as a really compelling figure to both listen to and read from. And then Denis Mukwege is a Congolese doctor who has treated women who are victims of sexual violence for a very long time and been an advocate for them in a very different kind of way. An interesting aspect for me to think about in this is that we rarely talk about in the U.S. context sex crimes as a weapon of war. We think about it in terms of something that happens elsewhere and not in our own kind of national security setting. But Moira Whalen, who I think we all know, had this kind of interesting Twitter thread about the fact that, like, you know, the typical national security defense outlets like Defense One, Defense News, Small Wars, and others don't focus on this topic, despite it being a fairly significant threat and risk for people in other national security contexts. And frankly, even like in the, you know, the ISIS context, something that we didn't really talk about as Americans.
You know, there's a lot of research and evidence on how sexual violence is used both as a tool for community control and as the sort of in-group formation. Derek A. Cohen at Harvard Kennedy School has a recent book on this. And there's a surprising amount of research on how important this is as an issue, given how little we talk about it in national security and national security policy settings.
It's also gotten some more attention in academic circles. Libby Wood at Yale has written a book on sexual violence in civil wars. And it was interesting that the Nobel Committee, you know, in addition to highlighting kind of the individual work of these two very brave citizens, has also highlighted that it was really that their work in addressing the role and the pervasiveness of sexual violence in the context of much larger violence. And that's, again, for folks who focus a little bit more on human security, this is a really important issue and one that, as you guys have said, doesn't tend to get a lot of attention. Well, that was supposed to be the good news part of this show.
I know, I was like, was our good news on sexual violence? Good.
We didn't do a good job of that. But similarly on the human rights front, we're kind of tracking in real time. We're recording Sunday afternoon and we're tracking this completely crazy story out of Turkey, where it appears, or at least it's being reported, we think leaked by the Turkish authorities, that a Saudi national went to the Saudi consulate in Turkey. One thing we can say for certain is that he hasn't been seen since. He's actually a writer for the Washington Post. His name's Jamal Khashoggi, and he had been quite critical. He was a reformer of, or advocate of reform in Saudi Arabia, had been critical of some of the recent steps under the current government there. And the reports from the Turkish authorities, at least in the leaked form, were that he'd been murdered at the consulate. The Turkish authorities are maybe walking that back a little bit now. This is interesting in and of its own, right? And we'll continue to follow the reporting on what exactly happened. But it's not the only instance of a kind of high-profile individual who's been disappeared, either by their own government or by some adversary organization.
If you think about just within the last year or so, the Saudis have effectively kidnapped several royal family and elite members of society in Saudi Arabia and moved them to the Ritz for a period of time before they effectively gave back some of their fortune for a variety of reasons. On top of that, three Saudi princes have disappeared altogether since 2015.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, from internationally in the same way that this guy has.
Huh.
What's interesting to me about that, well, what's interesting slash terrifying, code word terrifying, about me about this is that Jamal Khashoggi is... He is a, people call him a dissident, but he's not like a, like, you know, down with everything in Saudi Arabia. He's
a reformer.
He's a reformer and like is willing to reform within the current system. There was nothing like violently anti-monarchist about him. And, you know, he's been a journalist and a commentator for much of his life. He's actually worked for the Saudi government as an advisor to the U.S. ambassador a few years ago. And the fact that he has disappeared since is, I think, terrifying to a lot of folks who are critics of the Saudi government but have moved elsewhere. But on the other opposite side of that, we are now seeing a situation where Turkey is not really a trusted messenger.
I was going to say, if memory serves, they're not the most trusted. And also, have they not been having a little bit of tiff over Qatar for some time, or Qatar, or I forget how we agreed we were going to say it?
Qatar, what does it call the whole thing off? The Turks and the Saudis have never been the best of friends and are certainly not in a great relationship right now. But Turkey in and of itself has not been the greatest purveyors of truth in the last few years.
Or protectors of free speech and journalistic rights.
Right. So we're in a situation now where I think this is incredibly concerning to all of the above, whether the Saudis, the Turks, or just like protectors of free speech in general. And we don't have a trusted source of like what exactly happened.
Yeah, it's definitely a situation that's sort of ripe for misinformation and for mobilizing misinformation for other kind of parallel interests. There's, I think Tammy Wittes highlighted this on Twitter, that you sort of already see some of this happening amongst kind of Gulf Twitter accounts. But yes, it's it will be one of these things where it's very hard to know for sure ever what exactly happened. I think right now what folks are looking for is for whoever leaked the report on the Turkish side yesterday, you know, for the Turkish authorities to come forward with whatever evidence they had that made that seem viable.
So who wants to get disappeared?
Rod, I would like to talk about trade.
I sure would.
It's a guess.
Aaron, did you know that we have a new deal?
I heard something about it, but I can never remember the name.
How do we pronounce it?
I think it's USMCA.
I think it's USMCA.
Oh, I like USMCA.
I mean, it was going to be USMC to honor the Marines, Aaron. And then
then their trademark office got involved. Let's just be clear.
That's right.
Maybe it's just pronounced URA America.
Plus, I mean, if you're going to make a deal on intellectual property, probably need to be officially for intellectual property. So
super. This is the NAFTA replacement, though, right?
This is the NAFTA replacement. So just for folks to remember, where we're at is this deal is not inked in any way. It's an agreement between the leaders. It still needs to be approved by Congress on the U.S. side and the legislatures in Canada and Mexico, and then signed by all the leaders. As a result,
details.
Key point, most of the provisions won't take place until 2020, which is conveniently aligned with other parts of the political process that shall remain nameless. So what's in it is largely reforms on the car and auto industry side of things, particularly having higher standards for what counts as North American. So it bumps up to 75% North American manufactured from 63%. It requires workers earn more than 60 workers earning more than $16 an hour have to make more than 30%. And then there's a little side deal where Trump like pinky swears not to add auto tariffs. I think it's not in the deal, but it's like a kind of side pinky swear, which is totally, I mean, binding. And Trump is a man known for his word. So I think it's going to be fine. Also, a kind of big deal was Canada opening up its dairy market like a tiny, tiny little bit. So
does that mean we get bags of milk? That's really all I want out of this deal. I want to just know what those bags of milk are like at some point.
No, no. It means that we can send them powdered milk and infant formula.
And like Wisconsin cheese or something?
That's right.
When I was in Toronto a couple of weeks ago, I was walking down the street and there was somebody, I assume, attempting to sort of protest something about U.S.-Canadian relations, who was handing out free yogurt in front of like a convenience store that's had like a giant Canadian milk sign in front of it. So, you know, Canadians are paying attention to this stuff. Don't you worry that they're not sleeping at the wheel. They care about their dairy.
Who doesn't really? And I will say, like, U.S. agribusinesses weren't like super happy with the deal as standard. They thought that it does a lot for the auto industry. And doesn't really do a lot for agriculture. So there was a statement and report that came out about that. There's also some environmental regulations and like efforts to let like workers in Mexico have more union rights, which is kind of, I mean, is great. I'm very supportive of these ideas and provisions. It was interesting and surprising, I think, for everyone that these were things that got included in the end. And the Democrats are kind of thinking about how to respond on that front.
Yeah. So one question I had is basically how much of this would have been included in TPP? Like most of it?
A lot.
A lot.
I think quite a lot of it. I think actually the most interesting parts that wouldn't have been included in TPP are the auto protections and defining what counts as North American.
Sure. That makes sense.
Interestingly, Phil Levy, who is on the Council of Economic Advisors in the George W. Bush administration, has a great piece in Forbes sort of talking about how these, the USMCA and the Section 232 national security tariffs, which you guys might remember, are the things we are imposing on steel. And there's a review on the auto industry that's ongoing right now, supposed to finish up like basically right around when the 2018 midterms are. It talks a little bit about how we're kind of, Trump administration's in a little bit of a double bind, where if that report comes back and they want to impose auto tariffs, they can do it, but probably not necessarily on this deal. Without like sort of jeopardizing the passage of this deal. So they could try to impose it on European cars, in which case retaliatory tariffs would make U.S. cars more expensive, but nothing done in Mexico and Canada. U.S. wouldn't really have any buffer against Mexico and Canada. So it's like the interaction between these free trade deals and sort of tariffs and localized protectionism regimes isn't really well thought out. And that's kind of the reason we got into this, like global free, right? These free trade agreements have ended up expanding and expanding because it's very hard actually
to do the regionalized blocks.
Exactly. It's very hard to do regionalized blocks, especially on things that have global supply chains. So, you know, there were other things that weren't included in the deal, the steel tariffs, most notably. So Canada is still facing US steel tariffs of, I think, 25%. Also in is the special challenge rule that Canada was very insistent on keeping. So that lets them challenge in a special court, not U.S. courts, violations of the trade deal.
Oh, okay.
So that's, I mean, there are some important provisions that do remain in there. But I think, you know, kind of remains to be seen how, A, much different the NAFTA changes or the USMCA changes are than the NAFTA original pieces, like how binding that is and what that does to auto prices and auto supply chains. And two, what that means for like the Trump maximum pressure tariff strategy on other countries related to the auto industry.
Yeah. I mean, when I first heard this announced, my kind of gut reaction is, like, especially on the wages, right? So there's an increase in sort of guaranteed minimum wage on the Mexico side, and that should hopefully make U.S. workers more competitive, you know, as well. My first reaction was, you know, does the Trump administration deserve some credit for effectively playing chicken here? I mean, did they drive the kind of ideal point closer to their own preferred point by taking an extreme position? Or did they get a little bit lucky and they were morons from walking away from TPP in the first place? Could be both.
I think it's a little column A, a little column B, right?
Okay. Can we shift to like a much sexier trade discussion?
Yes. Super micro secret spy Chinese spy chips?
Yes. We should stipulate by saying nobody's actually sure if this happened. But there was a Bloomberg story that came out Thursday, I think.
Yes. And before Radha either of you explains in detail, I did not read the story. I just saw the illustration, which was a pencil that had a microchip at the bottom of the pencil, and therefore just decided to assume that it was because the Chinese had embedded microchips in pencils, and therefore we were all at risk.
So like that, except that it's just meant to indicate the size of the microchip. It's on the pointy end.
It was a great design decision.
And they put microchips to place where most people put microchips, which is on circuit boards.
I mean, you could put your microchip on a pencil. You do you.
Yeah, right. But they basically have a quite elaborate story about a chip provider who does a whole bunch of the circuit board designs for servers, in particular for Amazon Web Services and for Apple and a number of other large companies. And the kind of, you know, TLDR version of this is, if true, some of those microchips that have been contaminated or been compromised by, they say, Chinese authorities have made their way onto U.S. government systems. And so, one, all the companies involved have like vociferously denied this, like not just like sort of pablum standard corporate PR speak denied, but like vociferously denied that they were even ever made aware an investigation was underway or anything. All of the sources in the Bloomberg business story are anonymous, which doesn't mean it's not true, but it definitely makes it difficult to kind of walk things back on exactly, you know, who's claiming what happened where. The classification issues in this make it also hard to adjudicate in public because there's a lot of folks who wouldn't necessarily know if there was an issue. And if you do know, can you say anything?
So you also get... the Chinese government statement was like amazingly Orwellianly like crazy where like, or like, is that a denial? No, wait, what? Are you saying it? What? It's a little bit like, no, we value safety and privacy, but also Chinese interests are our most important concern. And you're like, what?
It's a little confusing.
I will say, like, the only thing that makes this feasible is the fact that the Chinese government actually has control both of like a lot of economic and manufacturing assets and the like capital itself, and that they have such a large market share of this microchip industry where it's like feasible that you could seed things at inception, basically at the manufacturing stage, and they could work their way through the supply chain intact and into a system without anyone noticing. Like, it's crazy, but like mildly feasible.
And that's been the sort of stated and sometimes unstated concern about on the Defense Department side, at least at any rate, with regard to buying commercial off-the-shelf technology.
Well, and then on top of that, there was the Defense Industrial Base report that came out last week that really prominently featured China. There's a classified iteration of this, which I assume goes into more detail, but like even the public version talked about China extensively as a concern about, you know, the reliance on, you know, single source, unstable producers for things that are vital to our national security and an absence of a strategy of how to cope with this and deal with this, which is not like shocking or surprising to anybody, but it was, I guess, somewhat shocking and surprising that the U.S. government put it on paper in this way.
Well, I mean, it goes back to Rado's point on global supply chains, right? I mean, so, you know, Supermicro is a U.S.-based company, but that subcontracts out for certain chips to China, just like literally everyone involved in microelectronics, right? So there's a good Atlantic article that sort of talks about, you know, the origins of Silicon Valley are when they were chip producers. They made microchips. They almost, you know, Intel's still based there, but they don't actually do their production there any longer. And almost everyone finds it more affordable and productive and efficient to produce those overseas. And those overseas facilities are often in mainland China. And that creates very interesting and difficult challenges on the national security side, if you think, because these hardware hacks, as opposed to a software hack, which we're more used to talking about, but these hardware hacks have always been feasible. We've always sort of, I don't want to say assumed, but sort of believed that the economic interests of the Chinese government and the PLA would outweigh the specific espionage interests of collecting those chips and, you know, compromising U.S. systems.
But now we've hit a point where, I mean, their economic interests may outweigh that, but we don't really have a useful alternative.
Yeah, like not off the top of my head. You'd have to insource quite a lot. But supply chain management and supply chain security is a huge concern. It's in the industrial base report, Lauren, as you note. And it's not something that anybody has. I mean, there's a lot of testing involved in sort of certification on the supply chain, but it's hard to do on every chip, on every board, you know, on every platform.
On top of which, if anyone has been involved with U.S. certification and testing on basically anything, you're probably skeptical even listening to those words. I'm sure it's fine.
And maybe just to like close that and turn us over to White House mayhem a little bit, like this is also why discussions of trade and trade liberalization and national security interest had gone along sort of hand in glove for such a long period of time, because some of the alignment in economic interest was really intended to balance what would be natural national security tensions between allies, basically relying on that economic interdependence and economic activity to balance them. That might not have been a reasonable assumption. And while Trump is sort of pushing back on China, it's clear that these microchip related intrusions have been going on a lot longer than the Trump maximum pressure campaign. And so, you know, I think there's a really important question to be had here as we're rethinking sort of liberalized trade strategies and global supply chains and nation state security interests, how we really want to balance those two things.
Do you want to talk about competing with China?
Well, I mean, I hear we're never going to let them down.
We're never going to give them up. Never going to turn around and
White House
hurt
mayhem.
You.
Vice President Pence gave quite a speech this week at the Hudson Institute. What do we have to say about Pence's speech?
So I sort of read Pence's speech as kind of like an almost breakup speech of like, here's all the reasons that I know that I should break up with you. Like you suck in these like 39,000 ways, but also that I kind of want to get back together with you because there was no or very little mention of here's what I'm going to do about it.
Yeah, there was almost no mention of what we're going to do about it, right. Other than like look at people across DMZs or sort of
I guess.
Posture.
And yeah, it was almost like in some ways it was like a massive compliment to China in terms of like look how much you're
screwing us. I don't
think
that's how they take it.
Well, I don't know. Probably not. But like they
most of the write-ups that I saw emphasized that it was the first time that American officials said out loud and in public the full list of grievances.
Okay, so the full list of grievances, and I guess like if you're an orchestrator of said grievances in China, you might be like, that's right. On the other hand, it's probably a little annoying that everybody's noticed it at all of the above, that it's not just military shows of force in the South China Sea. It's not just trade wars. It's not just political influence. It's all of the above captured together on top of their diplomatic and diplomatic debt strategy that they're pursuing on the Belt and Road Initiative and in Africa. Like, China's kind of in our shit.
They're up in everything. Van Jackson had a good piece, I think, in War on the Rocks, sort of replying to that. I think several of us had a chance to read, which talked about the importance, or basically that competition is not a strategy, which I thought was like very succinctly put. Like noting that we're in competition, and I have lots of thoughts about this language about competition, but that, again, like there was no, like how are we going to win the competition? What are the parameters? What are the fields of play of the competition? What are the comparative advantages? I mean, it kind of, you know, begs for a net assessment, possibly to be addressed by the new podcast, but...
Well, it's interesting that you say this, because Andy Marshall,
of great
grandfather
fame.
Of net assessment, was the also grandfather of... competition strategies, which is not how he used that word in a way that they're not using it right now.
No.
His form of competition strategies was, you know, incenting your adversary to expend themselves and invest themselves into ways that were highly detrimental, but in your favor.
If anything, that's being done in reverse right now.
Exactly.
We're spending tons of money on things like hypersonics, even though we are unsure exactly what
we
operational plan they you know, or problem they solve for us. Whereas the Chinese have very clear things that they seem to solve for them. As one example. But yes, competition, not a strategy.
Yeah, you need a t-shirt that says that. Another piece about this is that a laundry list on the competition / strategy point, a laundry list of complaints doesn't give us a great level of insight into what are the big things the Trump administration is like, this is what we need to quote unquote win on, and where is the compromise or sort of negotiation ground? Because China almost surely, and by almost surely, I mean definitely, has a similar laundry list of complaints, right? And that's kind of, in some ways, the nature of, like, sort of international relations. And that's fine. But if every single thing is wrong, then there is no space for compromise. And you kind of set up a like no-win adversarial relationship, which is why I think a lot of people felt like this was a portend of like Cold War, Iron Curtain, blah, blah, blah.
Well, so Van makes the point, you know, that it does, this language of competition, absent other context, sets you up to see everything as zero sum. So that you don't seek any out any mutual advantage, whether that's in North Korea or on climate or in other spaces. I mean, certainly there are people in the administration who would say that's because there is, it is zero sum. There is everything that they do that improves their themselves, you know, comes at our loss. I tend not to agree with that. The piece on the competition side that I'm most interested in is that we've been, for most of our adult lives, certainly, but you know, since you know 1992 or three. You know, had such an incredible amount of primacy as a kind of single hegemon. I mean, there was a unipolar moment, if you want to use that language, but we've been, the United States has been so much farther ahead in terms of economic and military strength that I sometimes wonder if we remember what it means to compete. Like, competing means that, like, you might be down in the third inning, right? Competing means that you're, you know, starter, you're starting quarterback, like you fill in your kind of, you know, metaphor here, might get knocked out, right? Competing means that you have to like run the race till the end, except that here we don't know what the quote end is defined as, right? It's sort of time unlimited. And we are so used to being so far ahead that anyone getting any closer to us feels like we're losing.
This is kind of where my colleagues at CNES come out, who have both spoken about this and written about this recently and pursuing other initiatives, that, you know, we are, you know, to your point, Aaron, we are sort of playing with China as though we were the straight A student who has now gone to college and realized, no, I actually have to try this time. And we haven't figured out how to try. And like that, you know, competing as against China, like, okay, fine. Yes, by all means, care about competing against China, but also care about competing as the United States. Are you, you know, China clearly has a global strategy that they're pursuing, or at least a regional strategy they're pursuing on a number of fronts. We do not, or at least not a cohesive one. What we tend to contradict right. ourselves both in the Middle East and Southeast Asia and, well, basically every part of the world. And they're not doing that. I mean, we're a democracy and we kind of fuck ourselves up by having elections that go back and forth in terms of whatever our global intent is. But to the extent that we could better advantage ourselves in this competition, we have not yet chosen to do so. And in the Trump administration have thoroughly weakened ourselves on the political and development aid front.
And with the allies.
Exactly. So I was going to say on the regional strategy point, like one thing that's interesting is I could imagine a state of the world where sort of pitting China as our number one adversary buys us ground with other allies that maybe we think will be useful with, say, India or even Japan, though I don't know why we need to buy ground with them, but bygones. What's concerning about this is a speech with this kind of rhetoric and this kind of structure that doesn't appear to be nested into a broader strategy other than one of general like belligerence and feeling that everyone should just do what we want all the time feels more like sort of tantrum policy than actual national security policy. And that's, I think, a concerning structure for engaging with a country that does have a pretty clear and deliberate approach to relationships, but also a pretty clear and deliberate approach to like retaliation and making sure their national interests are met with things like economic responses, with sort of, you know, intelligence and other types of intrusive effort. So,
and who has some pretty advantageous geography, right? I mean, yeah. This is all a home game, at least the East Asia and Southeast Asia pieces of this. And so for us to compete requires really significant effort. And for them, it requires them to have a basically normal view of their own national interests. And that's a tough imbalance.
Yeah.
Well, Vice President Pence was not the only person to give a speech last week. It turns out, I don't know if you guys remember that John Bolton is a national security advisor.
I had forgotten, honestly.
But it's been about 6 months.
How could you forget that mustache? I mean, come on.
It's been about 6 months since he took the job, and he's kept a surprisingly low profile.
Well, he was working really hard on this speech.
Right, I guess so. So he's given a couple of speeches. A couple of weeks ago, he talked about the International Criminal Court, which was a very interesting first return to public life at some level. I don't know why that would exactly be your first speech out, unless it was a thing you've been obsessed with for 25 years, which it turns out it is. And he also talked about Iran. So we'll come to the Iran speech here in a second. But the ICC speech was notable only in that it was, again, kind of obscure, but it really emphasized this question of like American sovereignty, and that in contrast to the Europeans, who, by the way, are in most cases our NATO allies. You know, the U.S. does not subscribe to any sort of vision of global governance. We will not be bound or have our hands tied by any global architecture, and really emphasized in particular that we would not participate in or submit to any human rights investigations from American actions in Afghanistan, which is the specific thing that he was talking about. That actually has been stated American policy for some time. The Obama administration kind of tried to have its cake and eat it too by bolstering the court in other quarters while remaining insistent that it had no jurisdiction over United States, American personnel. The U.S. signed the Rome Agreement, but never ratified it, which is a thing that we do that I'm sure infuriates freaking everybody around the world. But is U.S. policy has been ICC for thee, but not for me. And it was interesting that Bolton found it so important to emphasize. That said, his bits on sovereignty very much tied into Trump's U.N. General Assembly speech, which we'll get to here in a second. But before we talk about Trump's speech, John Bolton's Iran speech was like a blast from the past. I mean, it was like putting the band back together. I mean, you could have taken all of the speeches from 2002 and 2003 about Iraq and just switched one letter and you would have a significant part of this Iran speech.
And also, actually, you could have melded it with the doom and gloom from the Trump inauguration speech.
Where
you're like, everything is terrible. The world is literally on fire. But under the leadership of Donald Trump, we're going to fix all the thing by, you know, doing some indeterminate stuff that's going to be winning by us doing things, but also collaborating, not partnering, collaborating with foreign leaders. I don't know if folks read the counterterrorism strategy, but I particularly enjoyed the terms collaborating sprinkled throughout us. Guys, is that the word we use?
It feels kind of dirty.
Yeah, collaborator does not always have a great connotation to it. The other piece of the Iran speech, though, was also Bolton emphasizing repeatedly that, one, that there would be hell to pay for anyone, you know, basically caught collaborating with Iran, and him saying to the Iranians, we are watching and we will come after you. That's some pretty, you know, inflammatory language. But he also saved a fair amount of rhetoric for other allies or partners who continued to do business with Iran. So one of the things we haven't really talked about in a while is not just, you know, the U.S. obviously left the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear agreement, but the kind of teeth to that departure is the snapback of sanctions. And those haven't happened yet, but we're looking for them to be reimposed later this year. And that has put a number of European countries, including key allies, the United States, like Germany and France, between a rock and a hard place.
Those are the secondary sanctions that...
Terrible. So they actually made some comments on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meetings in New York last week as well, saying, basically calling the bluff, that they were going, that the EU in particular was going to look for a special purpose vehicle to avoid US sanctions, by which they mean they're going to find ways to do this trade in non-dollar denominated amounts. And we're not looking to be caught up in secondary sanctions and are not looking to expose their local businesses to those secondary sanctions. So that could get interesting pretty fast.
Again, hearkening to this point of lack of strategy, what I think was most concerning about the Iran speech, which is always what's concerning about any of these things, and actually even more concerning with this the national counterterrorism strategy, they really sort of in coincidence with it, is that it seems to completely ignore all of the context and all of the things we have learned from like counterterrorism operations over, I don't know, let's say hypothetically 17 years, just writing a random number there. And in particular, it kind of goes on and on about ISIS being our number one threat and a concern on ISIS and ISIS related groups. And then on the other hand, this sort of Shia, Hezbollah, Iran sponsored could force without any sort of recognition about the internal conflict between these groups, the regional instability and issues with that, or any of the issues and frankly limitations we've had with our partnered operations and partnered strategies, not the least of which is the Niger operation and death of service members, which we're still sort of learning about and talking about to this day and happened under the Trump administration. So as you know, I am generally a big fan of counterterrorism strategy that just involves killing people. And I don't need a lot of like meat on the bones of this to say there are a bunch of bad guys. We should have operations that sort of target and remove them from operational capability. But I feel like you want at least some rudimentary understanding of the different groups at play.
And you might want the strategy to conform to something like the authorization of the use of military force, when in fact, John Bolton says that we're going to stay in Syria until Iran leaves.
Which is not what our Secretary of Defense says. And I feel like this
or the Secretary of State, really? No. I mean, there's you know, if they would, maybe they should have a principals committee meeting to sort that one out, because it sounds like there's some people with some divergent views on exactly what we're doing in Syria.
And like, we laugh about this as though, like, it is funny, but it's also like we are putting service members and U.S. diplomats' lives at risk for a strategy that we haven't even bothered to have a meeting on. And that really bothers me. And it should bother a lot of you.
Can we talk about Trump's speech at the General Assembly?
So I read a great take on this that I liked, that the first year he gave a speech at UNGA, it was just like appalling and everyone was just horrified, like, who is this man? And I'm so offended that he's even there. And that this year he was just kind of like an old joke and whatever, we can take advantage of them. He's kind of a sucker. We can make this work for us.
The first time is tragedy, the second time is farce.
Indeed. What I kind of liked about this, I don't know if anyone remembers this, many years ago, Trump had a tweet about how he really hates the marble behind the speaker's dais at UN at UNGA and would personally pay to replace it because it's spectacularly ugly. This is one point where I thoroughly agree with the president that, like, yes, it is very ugly and we should replace it. So he did not take advantage of his time as president of the United States to do so yet.
Well, he should work on that. It was really interesting, though, as a contrast to last year's speech. Last year's speech talked about Rocket Man. Last year's speech was sort of fire and fury. This year was, again, it had a lot of this language on sovereignty. He talked about getting rid of the ideology of globalism and accepting the doctrine of patriotism, and called out, in particular, our allies in India, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Poland, which is a very interesting mix of countries, not all of whom I would call attention to our relationships with, but it was definitely a sort of, you know, there is no multilateral architecture, there are no international organizations, there's only self-interest. I mean, it was almost sort of like if you had, you know, Morgenthau write a textbook from 1945, this is all just self-help and self-interest, and we'll get through it together when the good guys win.
Or who has managed to take Stephen Miller out for dinner recently that he really enjoyed and therefore would include them in a praiseworthy speech?
Right.
Because clearly Stephen Miller wrote the vast abundance of it. I mean, these speeches, that's what's funny about this, is like he's not addressing the UN General Assembly. He's addressing his base from the pulpit of the UN General Assembly, and they love it.
They do love it. Pop culture?
I watched Poldark last night, and I have good news and bad news.
Okay.
The good news is there's a scene where Ross swims in the ocean and then comes out of the ocean. And if you've seen the version of that with Daniel Craig in James Bond movies,
it's just like that, but in Cornwall.
Correct. So, I mean, you know, on the other hand, you know, I'm all for a good slow plot development and British dramas. But even for me, this was a little bit, it's not really going anywhere, and it's not clear that's going to be great.
No one learns anything in Poldark, right? They're all exactly the way they were when we first met them.
They sure are.
They're just completely impulsive and beside themselves. There's no learning, no sharing. Seinfeld in a tin mine.
So, you know, come for the swimming, don't stay for the plot.
I've been obsessed all weekend with the Banksy art museum, art auction plot. Did you guys follow this?
No.
It was amazing. Oh my God, Radha, you didn't follow this? This is great.
So this is a famous print, or maybe the original, of a, you know, Banksy is this, you know, British street artist who's sort of anonymous, and he has these sort of canonical, more permanent paintings, one of which is a girl drawn in silhouette in a red balloon. And like you can kind of impart any number of meanings, you know, onto this. And it sold at auction at Sotheby's for like $1.3 million. And like as soon as the gavel goes down, the painting starts like sliding through the bottom of the frame and shredding.
God, it's so great.
It's so amazing. And so Banksy released a video a few hours later that shows him installing a shredder into the frame, I mean, years ago. So this is clearly like basically now like gone from like an art, like, you know, just a painting to like actually an art installation. But like all I can think about all weekend is like, who triggered? What was the trigger?
Right.
Yeah. Was it the gavel? Because that's amazing.
Was he watching the whole time?
I mean, it could have been on video, but like I think somebody in the room had to have been on a remote trigger. And so I am obsessed with, I need like Patrick Radenkeef or Nick Schmidl or somebody to like write the New Yorker version of this story, because I need to know who pushed the button and made the shredding start.
You know what I actually need is Sherlock to come back and have an episode about this.
Okay, I need Sherlock to come back and not suck, and then they can do an episode on this.
That's fair.
That would be great.
Yep.
I'm going to go see A Star Is Born this afternoon.
As I said, this is not a feel-good movie. This is a feel-like-you-swallowed-glass movie. Yeah. So I wish you the best of luck.
It's going to be great. I can't wait.
I am reading Dorothy Sayers' Gaudy Night, and it's just so delightful that I just want to hug it like a lot.
Perfect. Well, good. Maybe I'll read that after I swallow glass at the movie theater. All right, ladies. That's it for now. See you all in a couple weeks.
Cool. Thank you.
Bye.